Well, it's good to have the Hunters back. I know you guys have been away down south for quite a while, and you do fill up a row, which is nice, and it's nice to have Kevin to exhort to us this morning. Brother Kevin.
Morning, everyone. It has been a while, and it's good to be back. Rebecca, unfortunately, doesn't get a respite. One of her younger sisters is getting married next weekend, so we were back for all of 2 days, and then she turned around and had to fly east with the younger kids. So it's been a busy summer, but a good summer. I struggled not to exhort on 1 Kings 22 this morning because really I find that one of the most gripping chapters in the Old Testament about the redemption of Ahab. As part of our trip back, we actually were able to coincide with Oregon and the path of totality of the eclipse. So that's kind of more present in my mind this morning. So I want to talk a little bit about the eclipse. I assume everyone here knows what I'm talking about, saw it. It was visible here. I think it was about 91% or something of totality here, those of us who watched it from Victoria. Our house sitting in California ended at the beginning of last weekend, and 3 or 4 months ago when I was planning our trip back, I was trying to find hotels, and there was no hotels in Oregon. And so that's when I first woke up to the fact that there was an eclipse there. So we ended up finding a hotel a couple hours south, actually, of the path of totality. Got up at 5:30 in the morning and managed to get in to see it. Unfortunately, I planned our escape poorly. And after 4 hours on the I-5 at an average of about 20 kilometers an hour, we bailed off and luckily found a hotel south of Portland and came back the next day. But I would like to talk about the eclipse for a few minutes this morning. So for those of you who haven't been immersed in the newspapers and read 50 articles about it already, some of the basic facts are that the eclipse on Monday crossed North America. It was visible in some part across all of the hemisphere, but it crossed the U.S. from west to east, hitting the coast of Oregon at about 10:16 in the morning. And obviously the closer you got to that narrow band of totality, the darker it was. And so here there must have been decently visible, I believe. The reason we have eclipses at all is that there's an amazing coincidence of the sun being just about 400 times larger than the moon and 400 times further away. So to give you a sense of how unique this is, there's about 60 other significant moons in the solar system. There's only one moon that from the planet it's around, you would look up and it would be about the same size as the sun. It's a little moon called Prometheus that goes around Saturn, and the total eclipse would last about 1 second if you were watching from Saturn. So the fact that from our perspective here on Earth, we look up and our single moon is the same size as the sun is remarkable. It's an important thing because it's important for science, first of all, because when the moon overlaps the sun, you can see the corona of the sun, and you learn a lot about what the sun is made up of. And what they've learned from that, they've then been able to apply to the other stars and understand more about the universe and, in general, other solar systems outside ours. It's also very useful from a historical perspective, because now that eclipses can be mapped out across time, we can use that to align our calendar with historical calendars of other cultures. So when we read historical accounts from the Aztecs or the Mayas or the Incas or Oriental civilizations, when they talk about eclipses, we can use that to match that to our calendar dates, and it helps us to pinpoint historical events all through history. Eclipses are also useful for proving the theory of relativity. So Einstein had some theories about how gravity would warp light. So when the moon is in front of the sun and the stars are for a moment visible, scientists were able to measure that the stars that were close into the sun actually appeared to be in a different spot from where they were, which is something that Einstein had predicted in his theory. So there's lots of reasons why eclipses are remarkable and they're useful. Generally speaking, total eclipses will be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So on average, each spot on the Earth would get a total eclipse about once every 375 years. So the next actual total eclipse in North America is in 2024. So it will sweep up from Texas through to Toronto. So there will actually be a group of people who will have seen this one that went from west to east, and that one, and there will only be a 7-year gap. But I was just out of curiosity checking dates for when the next total eclipse would be in different cities in Israel, in Jerusalem in particular. And the article mentioned that for some cities, they won't see a total eclipse for at least another 1,000 years. So on average, each spot on Earth will see a total eclipse every 375. For most of us, if we see one at all, it will be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The reason I wanted to talk about it this morning is that as we watched it, we were struck how many of you watched it in a place with lots of other people? Like, did you go out to a public park or a stadium or anything like that? So we watched it in a place where we were surrounded by people, and we were struck by the fact that all these people stopped what they were doing and were staring up into the sky. And it so much reminded us of verses like the one we read this morning in Revelation 1, that every eye shall see him. It seemed like a moment closer to the coming of Christ than any that we could imagine in our normal lives. That for a moment, everything stops and every eye is up in the sky as people stop and look at what's happening. And I think these things are there intentionally. As I've said in other exhortations, I think God has designed our world so that if we're awake to them, the natural things are constant reminders of spiritual things. So, for example, some of the obvious ones that we know, like bread and water, we eat bread and we need water, and Jesus says these are symbols of the spiritual nourishment that we need to give us more eternal life. Darkness and light are allegories for ignorance and truth. And when we see night fall or when we see the sun rise the next day, we're reminded of the superiority of light over darkness and how warmth is better than lifelessness, which teaches us that knowledge is better than ignorance. And of course, the knowledge of God is best of all. The rainbow, for instance, teaches us about God's covenants, that God has made commitments that he intends to keep them. And so whenever we look up and see a rainbow, we know that it's just not just a meaningless scientific event. It's actually something that God has said is a mark of his relationship with us, that he will keep his word. And as someone who's had some employment uncertainty over the last few years, I'll tell you that I see birds differently. Whenever I see birds flying around, I think of the passage where Jesus says that God takes care of the birds and he'll certainly take care of us. And so there's different ways that God speaks to us through the natural world. And if we're listening, we can hear spiritual messages in those things. Come with me to Matthew 24, because as you all well know, the darkening of the sun is something that is mentioned often in Scripture in relation to the coming of Christ. So Matthew 24 is one example of that. Matthew 24, starting at verse 29, it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And these were the pictures, these were the verses that were coming to our mind as we stood there, and everything went quiet, and this light appeared in the sky, and everyone was transfixed by it in a way that, as I'll say in a minute, like there was no way we could have anticipated how we would have felt when we actually saw it. A couple other passages from Joel, for instance, Joel chapter 2, verses 30 and 31. It says, "And I will show wonders in the heavens and on the earth, blood and fire and columns of smoke, and the sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes." So in our experience, the moon was just black. Reading up a little bit about eclipses, sometimes when there's an eclipse, the light around it is shifted to red. And so you'll see like a reddish effect instead of the dark hole in the middle of the sky. Interestingly, that red moon and sun is also the effect from forest fires and just, I would imagine, from war and things like that in general. So you would have seen that here. And we saw that driving up through Oregon as well, the red moon and sun. Again, here in Joel, actually, in chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. "Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining." So these were all the things that were popping into our mind as we witnessed this event, as we stood in the field with hundreds of people around us with their eyes turned up to the sky. So I wanted to talk about, I guess, that lesson for us and a few other ones. So as I mentioned, we left Roseburg, Oregon at about 6 in the morning, and it was stressful from the start. We'd arrived at the hotel late after a 10-hour drive. The parking lot was completely full. So then we set alarms for 5:30 in the morning. By the time we got to our car at 6, most of the cars were gone. So everyone had the same idea. And so I had this fear that after all this preparation, we were going to get onto a gridlocked freeway and somehow get stuck south of the path of totality, and it was all going to be wasted. So we got on the freeway around 6 in the morning, and we went to a town called Albany. Once we got to Albany, it was just a normal day. And so that was kind of odd. There was a few groups of people that were kind of clustered around this park. It was by the freeway, so the cars were still driving by. People seemed to be doing their normal thing on a Monday morning. There was a McDonald's across the street with cars pulling in and out. We walked down the street and got a coffee. There was no real evidence that this was going to be an unusual day. So come with me to 1 Thessalonians 5. And Paul says, starting at verse 1, "Now concerning the times and the seasons, brothers, you have no need that anything be written to you. For you yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. While people are saying there is peace and security, then suddenly destruction will come upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. But you are not in darkness, brothers, for that day to surprise you like a thief. For you are all children of light, children of the day. We are not of the night or of the darkness. So then, let us not sleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober." So for scientists and other astute observers of the sky, they knew what was about to happen. For the rest of us, it would have been completely unexpected. It's not like there's a pattern where for the days leading up to the eclipse, you see the sun and the moon getting progressively closer together, and you could anticipate that this is what's going to happen. It was only evident to people who were specialized observers of the sky. Sunday was a normal day. And on Monday, the sun stopped shining. Because the sun is actually perfectly behind the moon, even as it's about to happen, as you all witnessed, you have no idea that the moon is even there until it is well in front of the sun. But as Paul says to the Thessalonians, we are not in darkness for that day to surprise us. So one of the lessons that we can take from the scientific observer is that they were anticipating this event. So the moment when it comes is still surprising, but you can know that it's coming. And so the same thing I think should be applicable to us is, I think what Paul is saying here is that when Jesus comes back, we should not be taken completely off guard. It should not be a completely surprising event to us. we are told that there's evidence that we'll be able to pick up on. And in fact, in Matthew chapter 16, Jesus expects us to have some awareness of his coming. And he draws an example from the natural world and says that we're smart to look and interpret the natural world. Why can't we do it for spiritual things? And in Matthew chapter 16, it says, "And the Pharisees and Sadducees came, and to test him, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. And he answered, 'When it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah.' So he left them and departed." So Jesus says that God has given us the brain power to analyze the signs of the heaven and to draw lessons and to make decisions based on that. And he certainly has done the same on the spiritual side. So just as we can see that God is fulfilling his word in terms of the natural things, he will do it as well in the spiritual. The sign of Jonah, for example, in my view at least, the death and the resurrection of Jesus is a historical fact. He died. He came back to life. He's not here. He will come back. So why would we be surprised? So it starts slow, and that kind of lulls you to sleep. You know, the first, we had our eclipse glasses, of course, and you see the moon start to come across the sun. And then after about 5 minutes of that, the kids were all back in the car on their phones. And it was like, hey, what's going on? And so Callan said, you know, it's like watching paint dry. You know, it's really slow paced. And this, again, is something that we know is going to happen in the last days. It's like the parable of the 10 virgins. They knew the wedding was going to happen. They all got there. They're all excited. And then it was really slow in developing, and everyone falls asleep. The actual event does take some time to materialize. And in that slot, some can lose focus. They can lose their way. And then they're unprepared when the end suddenly comes, and it's obvious that something is going on. So we were standing out in the field as it was getting towards the end of it, and some random guy comes up to us and says, "Oh, do you guys have an extra pair of eclipse glasses?" So, you know, with the parable in mind, we said, "No, you'll have to go to the stores and see if you can find one." And he went, and he missed the eclipse. So tough beans, you know. It's the word says that's what we should do. You know, we actually gave him an extra pair. And so, you know, the vendors are wise. You know, they only sell 10 packs. And especially as you get closer to the date, you have to get bigger and bigger packs. So we did have a few extras. But the point is that everyone knows it's coming. But when it starts, there's a certain slowness about it that can kind of make you think, oh, well, I'll have time. I'll prepare later. And the same thing, I think, can happen to us with the coming of Christ. We know it's happening. We know the signs of the times are happening right now. And yet, they're progressing a little bit slowly, so we get distracted, we fall into other things. And when the end starts to come, there really actually won't be much time to prepare. As it got towards the very end, things did speed up. The air got cold, and kind of a chilly breeze swept across us, and everything started to get quiet. The street lights all started to come on, the lights on the stores that were automated. The light in general got really strange. It wasn't like that sort of dusk light where the shadows are long. The sun was still overhead. It wasn't obscured by clouds or smoke or anything like that. It was like something was slowly sucking the color out of the world, and everything became shadowy. Something that I noticed at the time, but I wasn't able to put words to, and I read about later, is that the sun is actually very big, so when the sun is out, our shadows have a bit of a fuzzy edge to them, which you may not notice. Once the sun is reduced to a slit, then your shadows start to have really sharp edges. So there was kind of like this weird twilight with really sharp shadows everywhere. And the sun up in the sky, colors washed out of everything. And then suddenly the sky started to fill up with stars. And of course the stars are always there. You just can't see them. And that actually took me back to the passage in Matthew 24 that at the last stage of this, it says the Son of Man sends out his angels and they gather the elect from the corners of heaven. And we don't think about the angels who are all around us all the time. And then suddenly, as we get close to the moment, the angels will be evident and they will be gathering the elect from everywhere. The end, when it came, was more powerful and beautiful and awe-inspiring than any of us had really prepared for. Even a speck of the sun is too bright to look up at. So right up until the very last second, you still have the eclipse glasses and you're taking them off. When the sun is fully covered, you can look directly at it. And I was frankly, I guess, overwhelmed by the silent beauty of this black hole in the sky with living white fire all around it. Perfectly quiet as everyone hushes all around you and things come to a standstill. And I had never realized how white, how pure the fire of the sun really is. This is something else that I read where someone was saying that we tend to imagine the sun as a yellow star, but really it's white, pure light. And so for about 2 minutes, we all stood there, in my case, with tears in my eyes, just staring at the sky, wishing that it would never end. And it says, when the Son of Man comes, he will be surrounded by the armies of heaven in fine linen, white and pure on white horses. They'll be like that dazzling, amazing white light in his coming. And that light was honestly the most powerful, the most beautiful thing I've seen in my life. And so I think God does speak to us through the natural world. He speaks to us of spiritual things and the things that we see each day. And like I said, he gives us daily reminders and food and drink to stay alive. He gives us weekly reminders of spiritual things in the bread and the wine. And then for those of us who have been witnesses this week, perhaps of a once-in-a-lifetime reminder that God has made the sun and the moon, and as surely as the sun rises and sets every day, and as surely as the moon is in the sky, God will keep his promises, and God will redeem his people. And when that moment comes, the moment that we've all been waiting for and planning for, despite the fact that we've been waiting for it and planning for it, it will surpass our wildest expectations, and we'll want it to go on forever. And thanks be to God that it will. Just finish from Acts chapter 2. And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. And even on my male servants and female servants, in those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will show wonders in the heavens above, and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. And the sun shall be turned to darkness, and the moon to blood, before the day of the Lord comes, the great and magnificent day. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. Even so, come, Lord Jesus.